Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, understanding takings. And Richard, we've got a recent Supreme Court decision on this issue, but it probably makes the most sense for us to start today by just getting the audience their bearings. So luckily, you are without rival on this topic. It's something you've written about extensively over the years, including in a justifiably famous book. For the lay listener, when we talk about this concept of takings in the context of American law, what do we mean and where does it come from?
Well, the place where it comes from is easy to identify. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. It is a typical illustration of the constitutional passive. They don't tell you who's taking it, but at the very least, it applies to the federal government. And by virtue of a series of judicial decisions, it now binds the state as well under the so-called doctrine of incorporation, in which certain guarantees that were originally only in the federal constitution after the Reconstruction Amendments now bind the state. So that's what it is. Then the question is, what does it say? And it turns out there are two kinds of takings. The first kind are called a possessory taking. And like everything else, it's a term of art. But the obvious case is where the government tosses you off the land, and then it decides to come in and take the land itself. And the current rule on that is if the government does occupy land or allow a private person to come into land under its instruction, generally, but not always, it's thought to be a so-called per se taking, meaning that unless there's some very, very narrow defenses of government necessity or something of the sort, the government has to pay. What counts as a possessory taking? One of the issues, which is actually relevant to the Nick case on its fact, is what do you do with an easement? That is the right that somebody has to walk over somebody else's land. And in a decision called Nolan against the California Coastal Commission decided in 1987, the late Justice Scalia says, an easement is a possessory interest because it allows you to walk over somebody's property. It's different, therefore, from a restrictive covenant, which only prevents you from doing something because your neighbor is allowed to demand it. The other half of takings law is a can of worms. It's called the so-called regulatory taking. And this is also a term of art. But what it roughly means is that the government does not go into possession of your particular property. But what it does is it tells you it is going to restrict the way in which you could use that property for your own benefit. A zoning law which limits you, to example, for building only commercial or only high rises or only single family residential. These are all typically thought of as regulatory takings. And under a decision that Justice Brennan wrote in 1978 in the Penn Central case against the city of New York, he came up with the conclusion that all takings cases of that particular form are balancing cases, which means you have to look at the strength of the government interest and you have to look at the strength of the private interest, and you put a thumb on the scale in favor of the government. So in that particular case, which I regard as just plain wrong, he held a restriction on the ability to build over an existing terminal to be a mere regulatory taking, not a possession of the airspace. What the government did is it says you can't use it. It did not say that it could use it as well. And so those cases are decided not under a per se rule, but under a rational basis test. When you get to the Nick case, it turns out it's one of these borderline cases. What the state of Pennsylvania did is it declared that if anybody owned a cemetery on private property, the public had a right to come and view it during daylight hours. So that seems to be that they've got an easement to enter the property, which would have been thought to be a physical taking under the Nolan test, but maybe it's a regulatory taking, who knows. What happened is our good friend Nick decided that he wanted to protest this, and the state government beat a strategic retreat and said it's not going to enforce this, but it's not taking it off the books either. So now you're in limbo. And what Nick did is he decided to file what we call a 1983 action in federal court. And a 1983 action is something which says that if there's any violation of your constitutional rights, including violation of those rights by a municipal government, you have a right to a federal remedy. There was, however, a case called Williamson against Hamilton Bank, which said you could only go into federal court after you exhaust all your remedies in state court. And so the Supreme Court essentially overruled that decision, critical for reasons I'll explain presently, and said you could go right into federal court and sue and bypass the state court system.
Okay, and we should just be clear. This case that you've referenced a couple times is the one that just came through the court. It's called Nick v. Township of Scott, Pennsylvania. Yes. So give us that promised gem from a moment ago. Break down the ruling here for us and what it means going forward, how it changes the landscape around
Okay, what happens is Williamson County was a kind of a nutty case. It had two elements as an obstacle. One of them says you have to exhaust all your administrative remedies before you could go into any court. And what that does is it tempts local governments to give you perpetual rights to appeal, amend, review, and so forth, so you never get into court. That is going to be subject to an attack in some case soon, as it should be. But the other part of it says you have to go first to state court before you get into federal court. Now, there is a case called San Remo coming out of California in 2005, which essentially puts the daggers into all of these federal claims. How does it do so? It says if you bring your action in state court, as you must, and there's an adverse judgment against you on the federal claim, then when you go into federal court, you're met by the defense of res judicata. What means is the matter has already been adjudicated, race thing adjudicated, and therefore you can't hear it again. So here you have a federal statute which says you have a federal constitutional claim against a state or local government in these particular cases, you can never get into federal court. And essentially, many people for a long time said this is just apoplectically crazy. And the majority by Chief Justice Roberts said this was an exceptionally poorly reasoned decision, which it was. And so he overruled it on the question of going to state court for it. There was a fairly vitriolic dissent by Justice Kagan, which I think was actually a fairly weak piece of work. But that's the dividing line. This was a 5-4 liberal-conservative split. It's not criminal procedure where Justice Gorsuch is, in many cases, very much pro-defendant.
I'm going to bring you back to that Kagan dissent in a moment. But first, we should highlight there was a concurrence in this case from Justice Thomas, who really seemed ready to play hardball with governments on this. Can you explain his perspective?
Well, I don't even remember it. But what his position about all of this was is that he simply wants to make sure that they have to toe the line. And he emphasizes what has constantly been the case in these areas, that when you start to look at these things, you have to say, that you don't want to treat the property rights as the poor stepchild of everything else and be out from underneath this. And this has been a line that he's been taking pretty consistently lately. It goes back, I might add, to the hearings he had in 1991. I don't know if you remember this, but you mentioned my takings book. And at that particular time, this is Joe Biden before he had his updo, takes out a copy of the takings book, shows it to Justice Thomas to be, and he says, if you believe anything that's written in this particular book, you are really not fit for service on the United States Supreme Court. And what Justice Thomas replied, well, private property is mentioned in the Constitution, which was a revelation to Senator Biden under these circumstances. He hadn't really thought about this as a particular problem. And this issue was going to get hot and heavy for a while until natural law and private property were displaced by pubic hair and Anita Hill's allegation, and I was consigned to the dustbin of intellectual history by virtue of a far more lurid subject. But he has been on this particular take. He's a kind of a tough-minded originalist on these sorts of issues, and he has much less of the kind of nuanced attitude towards these institutional arrangements that Justice Roberts starts to show. I think it's clear Justice Roberts is pretty much an institutionalist. He's written some fairly good, fairly important takings cases. He's not a comprehensive theorist on these subjects, but in this particular case, it's a procedural case. And the reason it's so utterly important is now anybody who wants to do anything with respect to a regulatory taking. Every rent control statute, every zoning statute, every anti-growth statute and so forth goes directly into state, into federal court. So if you're in New York or in California and you try to go into state court, you know, it's like a death sentence in the eyes of most people. You go into federal court, you now get these Trump judges there, and it turns out that you got a fighting chance. So this is really a case not about what the substantive rules are as such, but it's a question of who decides it. Let me give you a comparison. We have in the Constitution a set of provisions known as the diversity jurisdiction provision. And what this does is it provides, if you're an in-state guy being sued by an out-state guy, two people in the simplest case, the outside guy doesn't have to go into state court where local judges can show local prejudices. He can bring an action in federal court on a private claim so long as the two parties come from different states. And the change in form is always regarded in diversity cases as an essential element for the protection of individual liberties. 1983 was meant to do exactly the same thing, and now it's being read essentially as a parallel to diversity jurisdiction. You get a guaranteed federal forum, and every lawyer who's ever argued a case understands where you go is every bit as important as what you do when you get there.
So how about this very fiery dissent from Justice Kagan? She said that this decision – I will read you two quotes here. First, she says early on in the dissent, this, quote, transgresses all usual principles of stare decisis. That's the principle we should remind our listeners, that the court should feel itself bound by its own precedents. And then later she says, quote, under cover of overruling only a single decision, her quotation marks, today's opinion smashes 100+ years of legal rulings to smithereens, close quote. How do you react to that, Richard?
This is just madness. I mean, I don't know what it is she was thinking when she wrote this. You know, there are a whole variety of considerations you take into account on whether or not you overturn a previous decision. This is not Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas doesn't give precedent any weight, and that's what he mentioned in his concurrence. He just says your loyalty is to the Constitution. But Justice Roberts, he says, look, if it's a constitutional situation, more willing to overturn that because it's a matter of great importance. Well, 1983 isn't a constitutional decision, but boy, it's a major structural feature in the civil rights movement thereafter. You worry about the quality of the reasoning. Well, in this case, it was pretty dreadful. He worries about the reliance interest. Well, all this is going to do is to apply to matters going forward. He says, everything considered, given this a lousy decision, we want to overturn it. And I think he's right about that. This is not the kind of case where you really want to use precedent. Precedent is really important. Suppose you have a series of trusts and all of them are interpreting a given doctrine of law in one particular way, and if you overturn that particular rule, every existing trust is going to be blown up in some important fashion that nobody intended. So there's a common view which says that when you're dealing with rules about property, dealing with vested rights, you'd be very careful before you turn them. But this is just simply creating a form. It's critical, but it doesn't have the reliance interest. And then it doesn't blow anything to smithereens. Justice Kagan makes a billion-dollar blunder in this case. There are two completely unrelated doctrines which she manages to confuse. One of them is the doctrine of inverse condemnation, and the other is Section 1983 and where you get a form. So inverse condemnation raises the following question. If it turns out that the government wants to take your property today, but only wants to pay you tomorrow at some other time, is it able to take the property on the promise that it's going to give you just compensation plus interest down the road? And you could easily think of cases where this would make sense. You need land for a railroad. You have to build it now, or an airstrip in military times. So what the government says is, we're taking it now, we acknowledge the arbitration, and then we're going to give you an adequate remedy to figure out where that goes. It is perfectly possible to do that in a 1983 action. If there's a regulatory taking, and it turns out the government wants to do this by way of inverse condemnation, it then specifies that it's going to give this remedy. You have to check for its adequacy, but you can do that in federal court. You can do it in state court. There's a lot of precedent for inverse condemnation. The Williamson case, which deals with the 1983 action, is essentially inconsistent with every 1983 case that came before it, most of which did not allow these conditions to be attached. And so one of the key cases which is decided by Justice Roberts, but not given sufficient weight in my judgment, was a case called Patsy. And this is a case in which somebody wants the school sue system for a violation of civil rights. And they come in on 1983, and somebody says, you know, you got to go into state court, you got to exhaust your administrative remedies. And not so. If you're dealing with a civil rights case, you just go right into federal court, and you can figure out how to duke it out one way or another. And the state, of course, if it wants to defend itself, can expedite an administrative proceeding and resolve the thing to the satisfaction of the other party, so the whole thing will go away. Most people are not going to bring 1983 actions the day there's a dispute. It's like everything else. There's going to be a settlement, but the availability of a civil rights action in federal court will be a big chip on the way in which you allocate these. So the question is, 1983 does not distinguish on its face between civil rights and property rights. It does not adopt the so-called Caroline Products case, in which it said that, well, since there's a lack of political representation in race cases and so forth, we have higher scrutiny there than we do in property cases. That was a key case decided in 1938, because what the Supreme Court had done was essentially said to Congress, do whatever you want. And then by 1938, somebody says, well, what are we going to do about Southern segregation? Do you want to give the Southern states all that power? And in an opinion by Justice Stone, a famous footnote, he said, this is suicidal. And, you know, from Caroline Products comes Brown v. Board of Education and a lot of other stuff. Now, if you start thinking about it, if you're a person who is a small property owner in the state of Pennsylvania, do you want to treat this person as a juggernaut capable of defending herself in the political process? Or do you want to say that, you know, some interest group interested in cemeteries has run roughshod over her, and she's discreet, she's insular, she should get protection? And I think that's a nice line. My own view is I don't think discreet and insular makes any difference. I think if you're rich and powerful and somebody still wants to steal from you, the same level of protection goes. It's a terrible thing to say that, oh, you're always going to protect yourself in the political process. One, it's extremely costly to do that. And two, you often lose. What you really want to have for rich and for poor people, powerful and not so powerful people, are uniform rules of justice that everybody can apply. And I think that what's happening here is there are two things going on. Not only do you give the federal forum, but it's also a kind of a broad hint that down the road, we're going to get a little bit tougher on some of these so-called regulatory takings cases. So, for example, you know, rent control is a very key issue. There's a rent stabilization law in New York, which the New York Times likes, but is absolutely insane in terms of the way in which it cuts down on landlords' protections without any semblance of giving them a reasonable rate of return, as is required under many jurisdictions. If you had to go into state court first, real problem. But my guess is there'll be many challenges by different groups to this particular statute, and virtually all of them will go into federal court. And some of the judges may be very hostile, but some of them may not. And if the thing gets up to the Supreme Court, it seems to me, if you take Chief Justice Roberts' attitude that property rights are not poor stepchild and so forth, it becomes perfectly credible to say this is what the government has done. It's taken your land for now and forever, and it's worth $100,000 in the open market, and it's giving you a stream of rental, which it's not paying, it's the private tenant who's paying, which is only worth $40,000. Government wants to do it, fine. Pay us the extra $60,000 out of public revenues. That was a position argued by Justice Scalia in a case called Pinnell back in 1985, and it's the kind of thing which I think can start to resonate at this particular point. So I regard this as a change of form and a change of attitude, as perhaps the single most important decision of this term, because there are many other cases like the ones on delegation and deference which seem to indicate a sea change. But the opinions are so garbled, so confused, so divided, you really don't know how they're going to cash out. But this one, on the forum point, is perfectly clear. I believe that the exhaustion of state remedies is going to be next to be challenged, and they will introduce a much tougher futility requirement and probably say, if you want to hold these guys up in an administrative proceeding, you may get a year, maybe 6 months, but you can't do it for 8 years or 10 years, which is absolutely common in de rigueur today in all sorts of cases. I've seen so many cases where people essentially have to go 18, 20 years before they actually get into court, and by that time they've lost the interim value of their use. It's a kind of an abuse which is so disgraceful that it has to be stopped. And I think there's a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court which is likely to do it. There's no Kavanaugh-Gorsuch split on this particular issue.
The last thing I'll ask you is to walk us through the conceptual limits of takings. The text of the Fifth Amendment says private property, which in the vernacular I think often gets heard as physical property. But we had a very distinguished listener of ours ask you to address the question, is there a scenario under which, for instance, extreme levels of taxation could be classified as a taking? How should we think about the parameters?
Well, first of all, let's take this question a little bit. The answer about taxation is yes. But before we do that, let's go back and talk about what kinds of things are covered by private property. And it turns out there are lots of things that are covered. It's not only land outright, but it's mortgages, it's future interest, it's easements, it's covenants. But it's also things like intellectual property. You have a trade secret, you have a patent, you have a copyright. If the United States government were to say, oh, you've got this copyright in order to do My Fair Lady, but we want everybody in the world to be able to do it free of charge, you can still do it, but they can do it also. Taking away the exclusive right is always regarded as a taking. And the same thing is true with respect to trade secrets. The law gets completely messed up in some of these cases because there's a decision called Monsanto against Ruckelshaus in which Harry Blackmun made a $1 trillion blunder. He says, oh, yes, these trade secrets are property, but if you want to get a license in order to sell this, you have to agree to let certain people use it free of charge or at a low rate. And that's just wrong. The police power, which is not in the takings clause proper, but is clearly necessary to it, says if you have a gun and want to kill somebody and the sheriff takes it away, he doesn't have to pay you for the gun. It's essentially you're trying to protect the safety, health, and morals of the public at large, and for that you don't need to pay any compensation. And so the question then is, how broadly is that to be read? And before 1937, it was read relatively narrow and did not include stopping competition. Post-1937, the ability to stop competition, like in the labor statutes, is thought to be, quote-unquote, a police power justification, a conclusion that I very much hated. So that's the first part of it. It's much broader than that, and everybody acknowledges it. The question, though, is what are the defenses that allow you to take something for nothing under the police power? The other half of this particular problem is the taxation problem. And this, of course, is very important now because we have the Elizabeth Warren wealth tax floating around. And there are several learned, I thought, completely erroneous statements indicating that it's perfectly okay. But let me review the bidding on that just a little bit. The obvious tax that everybody seems to like is a flat tax to pay for general revenues or for general support. So you want to run a court system, put a flat tax on income. Another tax that everybody kind of likes is what we call a special assessment. You cause particular damages to the roads by driving your heavy car tires on it. You should pay more than somebody who doesn't damage it at all. So the special stuff is designed to deal with one of two situations, either a special burden that a taxpayer imposes upon the system at large or a special benefit that that person receives from the system at large. And those are the two classes. In between, you get all sorts of other stuff. And so you mentioned, for example, progressive taxes. The basic text of the Constitution on the takings clause, I think, in effect, is a very strong argument for saying that you cannot use taxation as a disguise taking to redistribute wealth, and the strongest way in which to enforce that imperfect that it is a flat tax. There's a case called Pollock against Farmers Loan from about 1895 in which they get rid of the requirement that you have to apportion the income tax across different states. That was imposed by that case, and in the 13th Amendment it says you can impose an income tax without regard to apportionment under the census and so forth. So you could take rich people in rich states and tax them every bit as much as poor people in poor states, and everybody says that allows a progressive taxation. That's been dogma. It's not true from the text, but it has certainly received wisdom. But then when you get that, the next question is, well, how steep can it go? And can you have 100% progressive tax, a 90% progressive tax? And at this particular point, what we've heard from people is when we see one that's bad enough, we'll do something about it. But they haven't done anything about it as of yet. So progressive tax, at least for the moments, look to be safe. Death taxes are an interesting thing. There are two cases, one called Knowlton and Moore, and the other, Magoon is its name. And what they do is they say you're allowed to tax the transmission of wealth from one generation to another because that's a privilege, not a right. I think it's wrong, but let's assume that. So that's what gets you the estate tax and the gift tax. These are transmissions. It's funny to do it at the federal level because the right to transmit property under state law is not a federal right, but they do it anyhow. And the estate tax was then upheld a few years later. So these decisions all take place between 1898 and 1918. The wealth tax of Miss Warren is a completely different situation. There's no transfer, and there are no limits on the principal. She says you can just take 2,000 or 2% of the wealth from everybody on an annual basis, whether they transfer property or not. I think that's clearly unconstitutional under the existing precedent. And what's so utterly unnerving, if you read the arguments written in favor of it by Bruce Ackerman, Dawn Johnson, and Walter Dellinger, they don't see there's any limiting principle. It's 2% on $50 million today, 3% over $1 billion. Why not make it 10% on $100 million and 20% on $1 billion? They have no way of saying that those things are not there. So I think that the wealth taxes are all unconstitutional, and I think they will be held unconstitutional, certainly by this court, and then it's going to bring back just to what you do with progressivity. I'm in favor of striking it down. I always have been. I think, given the current wisdom, it's not likely to happen. If you go back and you look at the first of these cases, Magoon, in 1898 or so, what they said is, we've had inheritance taxes now. An inheritance tax differs from an estate tax because the estate tax is imposed on the amount of money that the decedent leaves, and the inheritance tax is imposed upon the amount that each recipient receives. So you can have 10 recipients at a lower tax than one big estate. So it's a more favorable tax. And one of the things the court said there is, we've been doing this since 1825. Don't bother us with anything else by way of constitutional argument. There's a huge amount of American constitutional law where challenges are made to institutions that are already well established. And what I tend to call the prescriptive constitution, the Supreme Court is willing to let that ride. Justice Kagan did that in the case of military justice just this past term. So I think what's really going to happen here on the taxation front is, I don't see any move to tighten the stuff, but my guess is any effort to extend the base of government powers through a wealth tax will and indeed should be struck down. What's clear on the business side is, right now I think the estate tax is $22 million for a couple. It's actually 22.8 or something like that, and it's indexed to inflation, so it only gets the super rich. And certainly when you start doing most ordinary people's estate planning, you tend to worry about the income tax that's going to accrue at the time of death more than you worry about the estate tax. For anybody who's got real money, I wish I could include myself into that category, but can't, say $100 million and so forth, they still have a big issue with the estate tax.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.